I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Health Care to order February 18th, Thursday. And colleagues, you have a Myrtlewood clock in front of you. That was something I was supposed to give you in 2009, but they didn't get it done. The Oregon industry here that makes these didn't get it done until October, so that's why you're receiving them now. All right. With that, Dr. Lace is here, so I want to make sure he can get back to some of those pediatric patients. So I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3663. Rick, would you explain the bill and call Dr. Lace up?
Thank you, Chair. You heard this. This bill does allow minors 15 years of age and older to consent without the parental approval to a diagnosis treatment by an optometric physician who's operating with that person's scope of practice. It does establish that the one exception would be when the minor is obtaining contact lenses for the first time.
And usually I don't let the opposition go first, but in this case, we want to make sure you can get back to your patients.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem. I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. Chair Moss Anderson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here, as you already mentioned, in opposition to the bill. This basically deals with having the ability to treat a minor without parental consent. And we do have in-law statute to allow especially girls the ability to receive birth control and or counseling regarding problems in that area. That the intent is there because of the potential for sexual abuse and family problems. This bill, we think, goes beyond what would normally be acceptable as emergency care. I've been a pediatrician for 33 years. We have eye emergencies. Children get things poked in their eyes. They have bruising. They have all sorts of bleeding problems in there. But in 33 years, I've never had an instance where there was an emergency that they had to go see an optometrist. They'd either go to the emergency room, they'd come to our office, we'd see them, we'd make a referral out in a timely manner to see an ophthalmologist. Never once have we ever had a situation where they had to have emergency care done to them without having any parental consent. This bill does not seem to be necessary in my experience. And if other people can show that data that there is a great need for that, then I can change. But at this point, we don't think it's necessary, and it doesn't really go or doesn't address an issue that's really there in our estimation.
Dr. Lace, I pulled my bill. We actually had passed a bill very similar to this. And the examples they gave was a 16-year-old high school soccer player is poked in the eye with a fingernail while playing a game in another town 2 hours from home. The player is in extreme pain and has difficulty seeing out of the eye. Another example, a 15-year-old living in rural Oregon stays with family friends while her parents travel out of the country. A potentially sight-threatening eye infection develops. And the third was a 17-year-old gas station attendant splashes gasoline in his eye while at work. Despite immediately irrigating his eyes with water, his eyes are burning and he develops blurry vision. So those were the types of examples.
Potential examples. And all those, and I can tell you all those have happened to children that I've taken care of. But in every situation, even without having a parent available, there is care available for that child through existing systems. You don't have to add on another layer of delivery. They either come in our office, we see them, they get sent down to the emergency room. In these situations that you're describing, there is an existing situation or an existing system that can deal with that. So that's why we don't see any need to add on another layer of this. I can't imagine that they're going to put a call out in a soccer game to the grandstands and say, is there an optometrist in the stands to come and help this particular patient. If the patient is having problems with the eye, Usually they're going to be taken into the emergency room or the nearest hospital situation. Nobody's going to be able to deal with an eye emergency on the field in anything that's serious. And so I think it's a little stretch to put those kind of situations out there and assume that there's nothing else available in terms of existing systems. So that's why we feel there's not an emergency, and it really doesn't address a real problem at this point.
Okay.
So if that answers your question.
Yes, and I'm sorry, Mr. Cross, you need to come up here because you're the proponent of the bill, but he needs to leave, and so we'll have you up right after. Well, Dr. Bates.
Madam Chair, there's a couple problems with the bill that we haven't quite got figured out yet here. First is, every once in a while, just for to be refreshing, I can sit down and read a bill. And I read this very carefully yesterday and last night, and the bill is written in a way that isn't even English if you read it carefully. And I called the scribblers up and said, how do you actually read this bill? And they explained to me how to do it. And then when it's written properly, it makes sense. But if you try to read it, it's not even in English. Okay? And we'll get to that in a minute. The real issue is the one that Dr. Lacy is bringing up here. And I've got a call right now into the medical board and talk to Ms. Haley. I called her 15 minutes ago, and she's going to call me back as soon as she figures this one out. As I read the statutes, it appears that physicians, MDs, DOs, nurse practitioners, and PAs apparently have a right to treat anyone over the age of 15 without parental consent, even if it is or is not an emergency. I said, appears. I don't know for sure. I didn't, after 30 years in practice, I didn't know I could do that, and I wouldn't do it. I always get parental consent, unless it's an emergency, child abuse, or something around contraception, all right? We're touching into an area that is really sensitive, and we're doing it in a special session. I'm nervous, okay? But I have a tendency, and the medical society is going to be opposed to me on this. I have a tendency, if we have that privilege now, that I would not have a problem extending it to optometrists. The real question is whether we should have that privilege now when it's not in our common practice to do this thing. We just don't do it except those very special things, abuse, contraception, and emergencies. I can't think of any other reason I would deal with someone under the age of 18 without parental consent. I just can't imagine why I would. So I'm not sure I'm very clear on the statute as it presently stands for myself after 30 years in practice, let alone opening up to optometrists. I'm pretty confused on this issue, and it's very, very touchy, and we're doing it on the fly. And this came at us out of the House on a 59-0 vote, and we passed something similar last session going the other direction.
Mm-hmm. With a lot of time.
And so all I can think of is if I made a mistake then, I don't want to make another mistake now. I'm not going to compound it by making mistakes twice. I'm not sure how to vote on this, and I want more time to look at it and think about it.
One thing I want to make clear, this is not a scope of practice issue. This goes beyond that. We refer our patients to optometrists, to ophthalmologists freely, and so we don't have an issue here where somebody seems like they're losing power or having a power issue. This is more about the reality of what actually happens. And so, like I said, in 33 years, I've never had a situation where I thought, geez, I couldn't use the existing system, even in kids who are outside the area. So I just don't think it's necessary.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Other comments? All right. Mr. Cross. You can go. Nan, do you need to come up?
Okay. Madam Committee Chair, committee members, I'm here. My name is Bill Cross. And for the record, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. I am distributing a statement from their executive director, Wayne Schumacher, who was unable to make it down this morning. But this is similar to Senate Bill 19, which was approved in the Senate in the 2009 session, and unfortunately didn't get a hearing in the House side. And so the House leadership made a commitment to started in the supplemental session, and so the bill is virtually the same as what you saw and approved in 09. There is one amendment to the bill which would restrict or require parental consent when the minor or the adolescent is or seeking contact lenses for the first time. And that would be precluded. Parental consent would be required. The types of issues that or situations that were and are identified in the testimony have occurred increasingly over the last 3, 4, 5 years. And in part because as the scope of practice was changed a few years ago, they've been able, optometric physicians have been able to provide medical eye care treatment, and for many, many patients, they are the primary eye care provider. Hence, they do get situations where the parent may not be able to provide consent because they're at work, out of town, they can't be reached, their cell phones are off, and the optometric physician can't legally treat them. Many are referred, or in some cases, they are referred to ER, and that's not the most cost-effective manner of treating them. And in many cases, in parts of the state, other, like ophthalmologists, who are able to provide treatment, aren't even available. They're geographically not available. So that was the reason the bill was presented. It came out of the House committee, as I say, with the amendment to adjust the contact lenses, and it was approved 58-0. We have tried to simply amend the existing statute as it relates to physicians, nurse practitioners, and dentists with regard to adolescents between the ages of 15 and 18. And I think pretty clearly, because of the practical situations of who's going to be paying for treatments and the similar to other practitioners, the code of ethics in terms of what a provider, what an optometric physician would approve to provide in the way of treatment to an adolescent who doesn't have parental consent would be similar, I believe, to what Dr. Bates was probably referring to in terms of what kind of situations are you really going to look at when the parental consent is not involved.
How many other states allow this with their optometric physicians?
Madam Chair, I do not know.
Okay. Questions? All right, Nan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology, the statewide association of medical and osteopathic physicians specializing in eye care. Our members do oppose this bill for the patient safety reasons that I'm sure Dr. Lace explained to you. It is a very, the reason that they oppose it also is that they don't do it. Their national practice guidelines recommend against it. We're not happy about opposing this bill. One point I'd like to make is that there is a lot more collegiality among between optometrists and ophthalmologists than you would think from being in this building. My associate and I just did some traveling outside of the valley and met with some of the ophthalmologists, and really they have high esteem for the optometrists they work with. Some of them even brought the optometrists from their offices to the dinner that we had. But they are concerned about this bill, and when we talk to them about it, they say, gee, that is not a good medical practice. Is there something that we could work out? We tried on the House side, and I walked into a total, waded into very, very hot water by suggesting that perhaps after treatment rendered under this bill, parents could be notified within 48 hours. And, of course, that brought the wrath of everyone down on me, and I became more of a pariah than I've ever been in 30 years in the building. So that didn't work. I would love the opportunity to get our people together and try to work something out that addresses the kinds of situations that they talk about. The teenager who gets gasoline in his eye goes to the optometrist instead of the emergency room, and the parents can't be reached. I would love to try to get our people together and work something out. I wish that I had done that before. I didn't really think of it because I thought we had an answer last week.
Madam Chair, just thinking here. Bill, do you know if there's a written code of conduct, ethics for optometrists anywhere? If you asked me that about my profession, I'd say,
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, yes, there is a code of ethics that the American Optometric Association has.
Is it concerned people between 15 and 18 of age?
Well, excuse me. Madam Chair, Senator Bates, know that their code of ethics is not specific to different standards of practice or care or protocols. It's more generalized, and so it doesn't reference, you know, specifically, you know, 15 to 18 year olds. But it does talk about the eye care access and the rights of patients.
Madam Chair,
more staff
stuff. When Dr. Lace was talking, I was wondering about, to the extent this is an access problem. Now, emergency room is always available, and I guess it depends on the type of injury there might be on a soccer field or whatever. And sometimes an emergency room is overkill, and maybe there is not a other access available, an optometrist. There are more optometrists out there than ophthalmologists. Is that?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that is correct. There are more licensed optometric physicians in the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
Typically, or in many situations, in emergency rooms, they don't have the diagnostic equipment necessary to examine eye injuries, and nor do they have the staff that have the background that an ophthalmologist or optometric physician would have with eye issues. So oftentimes emergency, you know, ER may not be the best solution.
Madam Chair, if I can address one question you asked about other states, whether this exists for optometrists. I tried to find that, and I couldn't find it. Couldn't find any state that had it, but it's also very difficult to find states that have the law we have in Chapter 109 that allows anybody, I mean, that allows physicians to do it. It's an unusual law. Not very many states have it. And I'd also like to say that there are ophthalmologists in rural communities such as Hermiston and LeGrand, etc. I think that's another kind of myth that we're not out there.
Okay. I'd like the committee to look at the examples that of some non-urgent examples. A 17-year-old girl, a prior patient, comes to the optometric physician's office after school for an annual examination for glasses and eye health, and her mother made the appointment, but neither parent could attend the exam due to a work commitment, and staff was not aware that the parent was not accompanying the girl. That's one. Another, a 15-year-old girl, a prior patient wearing contact lenses, walks into her optometric physician's office, stating her eyes feel dry. She requests artificial moisture drops for comfort. And the third example was a juvenile parole officer presents with a minor inmate at an optometric physician's office for an eye exam, and the optometric physician's office had no prior consent and now is faced with scrambling to contact a parent or guardian or canceling the appointment, wasting the time of the parole officer and the office staff and professional time. Are these real situations, Mr. Cross?
Madam Chair, yes, they are.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Madam Chair, I'd offer that for one of those situations, too. We do it all the time. We don't treat them. We get all the parents. We just don't treat them. And maybe I have the legal right to do so, and I just found, I mean, you find out things living up here. I didn't find out living in Medford. I have to admit, I'm just ignorant. And the only thing that makes me feel a little more comfortable about being ignorant is when I called the medical board and asked this question this morning. They didn't know the answer either, and they're checking it right now for us. So, we should have an answer within 15 or 20 minutes.
Okay, we have debated this for a couple years now, and I would like to close the public hearing on House Bill 3663, and I would like to open a work session on House Bill 3663.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3663 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3663 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Madam Chair, I need a little bit more information before I can make a decision. Sorry.
Madam Chair, I think in all due respect, I'm prepared to vote for this, but in all due respect to Senator Bates and so on, I think that we should wait.
Okay. It looks like there's probably a couple other bills that we'll be carrying over to maybe till this afternoon because there are some amendments. So I'm in perfect agreement to do that.
I think it's important that we look at all of the information and so on, and as a courtesy, there might be something there that would change my mind.
Okay.
And I would tell you that
for the purpose of continuity, I will withdraw my motion.
All right. Excellent. All right. So with that, we'll close the work session on... do I have to get a vote to have a...
If you withdrew the motion.
No,
yeah, okay. Okay, so I'll close the work session on House Bill 3663, and we may be bringing that back when we meet, probably a little later. And I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3631. Colleagues, I believe that...
I'm scheduled just for a work session.
Oh, I'm open a work session on House Bill 3631. Now, remind us what that bill is.
Simply, this does prohibit insurers from treating injuries from sexual violence as pre-existing conditions for coverage, underwriting, rating purposes, define sexual violence. You also looked at some -A3 amendments at the last meeting that would prohibit insurance policy from excluding payment reimbursement for services rendered by a community or regional assessment center.
And colleagues, I don't think there was any opposition to the underlying bill. Where we're having a little problem is with the amendment -A3. I spoke with a proponent of the amendment last night, and the one entity is Kaiser. Kaiser actually contracts with CARES Northwest, but not with the Children's Center. They contract with certain regional or community assessment centers. That's how Kaiser works. Other providers don't necessarily do that. And what we're hearing is that when bills are submitted to the insurers from a community assessment center or regional center, they're many, many times denied. And so somehow it would be nice to not put Kaiser on the spot. I like how their system is an integrated network. It has an in-house sort of network, but is there anything that possibly we could do to make this bill tell the insurers that when a patient goes into a community assessment center or a regional assessment center, yes, they are not a primary care facility, but they definitely are providing a primary care service because it's with sexually and physically abused children. So, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. In my read of the A3 amendments, it goes way beyond the scope of the bill itself. I will support the underlying bill. I cannot support the A3 amendments. I think this is another case of a bigger issue than we have time to deal with, and for not wanting to lose the bill itself, I would suggest we do not do the amendment and just move the bill.
Okay. Other comments?
I concur.
What I would like to do is at least go to LC to talk to them about this concept. And could I call John Powell and Dave Fiskum up here?
No.
Oh, Inga can come too. But I've talked to Inga a lot about this bill. I haven't talked to you guys. Yeah, come on up, Inga. What I would like on the record here is the information that we're getting is that when children, DA, say, refers a child to an assessment center, they probably don't know what health insurance they have. And if the Clackamas County DA refers to the Children's Center in, is it Oregon City? They don't check to see which insurance. I mean, these are, but still, I think there's time between when that referral is made and time where the family could be, maybe be informed. But my concern is that these assessments are being denied by insurers, and how can we fix that problem? So who wants to go first?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Ohio. Madam Chair, I think I'm not familiar with all of the services provided by these facilities. I know the assessments that have been described are very important and need to be done, and I understand these agencies do a very, very good job. I think the issue might well be for the insurer is the service being rendered by a licensed medical provider would be one. And two, the services that have been described, the assessment would obviously be a covered service. But other, I don't know whether they do other services that are billed to insurers that may or may not be covered. So I think the two items for the insurer is the provider, a licensed medical provider, one, and two, are the, all the services that they're billing covered services. So those would be the two issues. And I don't, I do not know about denials.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Dave Fiskum here for Providence Health Plans this morning. In the moment since you asked me the question about this before the hearing, I have not had a chance to talk to our experts. I would tell you the Providence Health System is fully in support of House Bill 3631, but we do not believe that we as an insurer discriminate now on the basis of sexual assault treatment issues, and in fact, in many cases, the insurer would not know exactly what someone is being treated for. At the same time, we're not opposing the bill. I don't mean to imply. I think Mr. Powell has put his finger on a couple of the issues, which is making sure that the services are provided by a licensed medical provider and in fact are covered. We're pleased to check on this issue. I think I have this question in my mind about how far a law, a bill ought to go to specify what is in a contract between two presumably willing parties to that contract. At the same time, we're not questioning the viability of services provided by such facilities as the Children's Center or others like it. It's possible that those who are looking at bills from centers might not be as aware and as knowledgeable as, for instance, we are about the services provided by that Children's Center in Oregon City. We're pleased to check on this in the moments we have before you convene again, Madam Chair. Thank you for asking us the question.
Okay, Ms. Deckert.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Inga Deckert representing Kaiser Permanente, and I had the opportunity to speak with most of you yesterday, and as you stated, Madam Chair, Kaiser is a little bit of a different model, an integrated health care system. Kaiser does contract with CARES Northwest to provide these services for its patients in the Tri-County area. That is a clinic with which Kaiser physicians have had a long-standing relationship. We have a pediatric physician actually in that clinic, and that is the clinic with which Kaiser's physicians believe can provide the best and most appropriate care for their patients, and Kaiser covers 100% of the cost when their patients receive treatment there. And so Kaiser, being the integrated model and somewhat closed system that it is, I mean, it treats these types of assessments and treatment the same way that it treats other medical care, in that when a patient goes outside the system to receive care, that typically is not covered.
Questions? Okay, we're in work session. Tanya Hunt, could you come forward to address the issues that they have put forth to us? And whoever else you want to have come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tanya Hunt, and I'm Executive Director of the Children's Center of Clackamas County. I appreciate your consideration of this. We also support the underlying bill. I think it's a very important issue around how insurance companies will treat victims of sexual and domestic violence. We specifically, as you know, deal with the children who are victims of sexual and domestic violence. One thing, Madam Chair, I want to clarify is that these cases are not referred by the District Attorney's Office. They're actually referred by law enforcement agencies who are investigating usually a very recent allegation of abuse, or they're referred by Department of Human Service child welfare workers. For an example, yesterday afternoon, we saw a child younger than 6 months old with extensive bruising all over their body. They were referred by DHS and local law enforcement, who are investigating those bruises. There is no opportunity at the point of intake to ask our law enforcement agencies or our DHS caseworkers what type of insurance a child has. It's our practice, and the practice really nationally, to not screen out children based on their insurance status or based on their insurance carrier. That creates a nightmare scenario for centers like ours who do this work, independent of whether or not a child has insurance or what type of insurance that is. And also it creates a nightmare scenario for our referring agencies who are in a usually very important and recent investigation of a sexual assault or physical assault against a child. So moving quickly is important. Being of service to those investigative agencies is important, and payment from insurance companies is definitely secondary to us. So we see the kids. If those children have private insurance, or OHP, we bill, and we are very grateful for the reimbursements we receive. When private insurance denies payment because we are not a preferred provider, we are not a primary care provider, we are not a contracted provider, it is frustrating. And our only recourse is to either accept that we will not get paid or to bill the State Crime Victims Compensation Fund, which is really established for children and other victims of crime who don't have medical insurance. So it seems unfortunate that any insurance company would choose to overlook the somewhat urgent and geographically sensitive nature of these cases, and instead rely upon their contracting rules, their primary care rules, and all those other things when we are providing the service independent of what they have or will do.
Okay, we're in work session. Yes, Senator Morissette.
The Child Center in Springfield is similar to the one that you manage. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Lane County Kids First also provides these services, and I've spoken with their executive director, and she supports this amendment. It is an issue for centers across the state who are denied because they are not contracted, they are not primary care, or they are not preferred providers, which is just not something we screen on when we see these kids.
Now, follow up, please. That's not the Child Center you're talking about. That's a different organization. How many places in Lane County, for instance, are child centers?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, there are 19 child abuse assessment centers in Oregon. Not all of them provide in-house medical services. And there are probably just 4,000 children who receive these type of medical assessments in the state in the course of a year. There is only one child abuse assessment center for Lane County. There is typically only one, there is only one child abuse assessment center per county jurisdiction. Sometimes multiple county jurisdictions, depending upon how the county multidisciplinary team establishes it. In Clackamas County, the county multidisciplinary team has designated the Children's Center as their designated medical provider and the one that they refer cases to.
And just for the record again, you said your center does about 300 assessments a year, and about 30 of those you don't get reimbursement for. Is that correct? And then the second question I want is the insurers were talking about various services. What do you bill? What do you actually bill for? Just a primary care assessment or other things also?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The first question, I'm sorry.
Well, answer the number. What services do you actually bill?
Thank you. Going back to that first question, yes, at the Children's Center we see about 300 kids a year. Of those, about 10%, the insurance companies refuse payment. I will say about 50% of our total population is either OHP insured or completely uninsured. So we have a large indigent population of people we're serving. But of those with private insurance, we have a total of about 10% who refuse payment, and then we're sometimes collecting for crime victims compensation or simply not collecting. The type of service we provide at the Children's Center is a primary care. It's essentially like a well-child checkup. It's a full head-to-toe checkup. Many times there are extended times added to that because it is so comprehensive. Usually our assessments take 3 to 4 hours for our medical providers, not counting the follow-up documentation, which could be anywhere from 5 to 10 hours of write-up, and that's not including any court time that might be required, depending on how the case proceeds.
Other questions? Yes, Senator Bates. No,
well,
oh, Senator Martin.
Well, I was just going to ask how you feel about removing that amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Morissette. I, again, truly support the underlying bill here, and after having some conversation with Inga, who represents Kaiser, and other representatives from insurance companies, there may be an opportunity for us to do some work over the next several months and perhaps find other solutions that are workable for all of us. So removing this amendment, while disappointing in the immediate, certainly does not stop us from solving the problem through other means or coming back in the next legislative session with maybe another solution that is workable for all parties. And again, I certainly do support the underlying bill and would not want to hold that up.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The services you provide are obviously very sensitive and very specialized, and appreciate your work. I wouldn't want to do it. I mean that very sincerely. It's terrible work to have to do, but it needs to be done. Do you service more than one county?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, we at the Children's Center, we serve all law enforcement jurisdictions in Clackamas County and the two DHS offices in Clackamas County. So we are the Clackamas County designated medical provider for these type of assessments. All those agencies refer to us. And that's typically how it is set up across the state. Once in a while, a center like CARES Northwest may serve two counties. They serve Multnomah County and Washington County. I believe the center in Bend serves multiple counties as well surrounding. Our county MDT has contracted with the Children's Center to be the designated service provider.
And I assume this was done, so go ahead, hold on.
Just to clarify a little bit, I was actually working for Clackamas County and was referring my clients to CARES if the situation arised. And we did find that there were some, for some reason or another, would never get their assessments. And who knows, it is primarily mostly indigent and low-income people, and there could be a variety of reasons why they didn't want to go to downtown Portland. But what then we did is we actually had, when we first started the Children's Center, we actually had a CARES physician and CARES staff that was housed at the Children's Center. And then over time, and that's what I just found out, they now are not practicing, and you have your own physicians, and the CARES physician is back at a center near Legacy Emanuel. So I feel that when Kaiser sets up his contract, it is definitely probably physician-driven. And why Kaiser has the right to not contract with the Children's Center, that's the issue I have a problem with. So that's why I sort of want to look at other creative ways to address the issue of, because some families are just not going to their assessments from Clackamas County all the way downtown Portland. I don't.
Madam Chair.
Actually, that's the issue I'm trying to get to. I mean, if a Kaiser patient is in Southern Oregon and gets injured and goes to the emergency room, Kaiser covers the service because they're so far from any Kaiser facility. Because Kaiser has their own physicians and contracts with specific hospitals and other organizations. I'm not quite certain because of the geography here. And it's clear to me that Kaiser has contracted with one group in this geographical area to treat these very, very special cases. And I'm not sure I want to interfere with that relationship. If the child we're talking about were injured or had a special need and was out of that geographical area, was in Bend or on the coast or in Southern Oregon, I would expect that Kaiser would then allow payment for one of those centers in those areas further away. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I expect it probably is. Mm-hmm. But in their own geographical area where they have their own services, I expect they've contracted with specific hospitals or in this case a specific center for that care. And I think that's the issue here. And I think you expressed it well. I think I've got that in my head now.
Colleagues, any other questions? What I want to do is I need to speak with the sponsor of the amendment one more time. So I'm right now going to close the work session on House Bill 3631. We will be moving the underlying bill for sure, but I just want to discuss with LC and then with the insurers and the proponent of the if there is any creative language that we could get to allow this without interfering with the contractual agreements like Kaiser has. So we're closing the work session on 3631, and I want to open a work session on House Bill 3665.
We're going to grab
the
base back in here.
No, I have the votes if he doesn't want to do it. So with that, I'll call, we're in work session.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain the bill real quick? And
3665 is the dental services contract bill. It does establish that a dental services contract cannot restrict the price that a dental health service provider can charge for services unless those services are covered by the insurer. And you did hear this on the 16th.
Colleagues, I know some of you have now contacted your personal physicians, your dentists, and it's my understanding that this bill would actually have the insurers would dictate to providers for non-covered services, for services that they're not going to cover, what they can charge. Like, let's just say, and I don't know if this is true, teeth whitening is not a covered service. The insurers would let this provider know you can only charge this amount for that. Or Novocaine, I don't know if Novocaine is covered or not. You can only charge, if it's not covered, you can only charge a certain amount for a non-conference service. So what I'd like is Sean Comer and Teresa Miller to just come up, just give us a little perspective on this, because I think we have the votes on the committee, but I want the committee to be aware of all of the ramifications here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Teresa Miller. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and you'd asked me to come speak to this bill. From my perspective, I understand this is an issue that's being debated across the country in various states, and unfortunately, it's not necessarily an area that at the department we have a lot of expertise on, and I just have not had the opportunity to do the proper research, quite frankly, to look into this issue to really understand the implications of the bill. So I'm sorry I'm not able to provide you much better information. I truly don't think I understand exactly what this bill would do. So for what it's worth, there you go.
Thank you. Sean.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Comer, Deputy Administrator, Office of Health Policy and Research. I will be an echo of what Teresa just said. I think that there's just a lot of detail that we feel like needs to be worked out for us to understand what the real impact would be.
I like when the pro from Dover comes in and goes, huh?
Okay. All right. Senator Cruz?
Well, Madam Chair, this may be a good idea, but these two folks sitting before us know a heck of a lot more about this than I do, and what I'm hearing from them is they don't know what the impact will be. And I think we should know what the impact of what we do is. But anyway, that's just...
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The discussion that I've had with my dentist is along the lines of, right now there is not an issue, at least in his practice and his understanding across the state, with these kinds of contractual language provisions. But the expectation is that it will be. And so, Madam Chair, I don't have a problem moving this bill forward and allowing dentists to operate within the context of their markets.
Are there further discussions?
I'm waiting to hear what Doc Bates has.
Oh, God. I don't know if I've had enough sleep last night, or I'm just confused generally today, okay? But here's the way I understand this, and I'm willing to move the bill. It appears that, from what I've been told, and I don't know if I can believe everything I'm told at the time of this building anymore, that the dentists are in a situation that they cannot form IPAs and cannot work as a group to negotiate contracts with a large insurer. So it's a very uneven playing field for them. Secondly, some of those dentists are in a position, between now until we come back in session, they're going to have to sign some contracts that are apparently multi-year contracts, 2-3 years at a time. If that's all true, then giving them some protection during this time until we actually get there in January, February, March, whenever we're going to meet again, I think would be worthwhile. I would feel a lot better if this thing had a sunset on it, frankly, of a year or two from now, so we'd look at it again. Something of that nature would give me a lot more comfort. Again, we're in a special session, we're moving fast, issues here that are very, very conflicted and difficult to look at. My sense is I can move the bill. I would also like to have it reviewed very carefully in February when we get back in here and be ready to rescind it if we need to.
Are you saying, since we're carrying others, are you saying you'd like a sunset on this?
Absolutely.
All right. Okay, are there any comments that from Nikki or at all?
No coffee. I got my coffee.
Thank you, Chair Mon Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nikki Terzieff. I am here on behalf of Oregon Dental Association. I want to just say thank you for your willingness to move this bill. Time is of the essence. We see these contracts coming into effect January 1, 2011, and Senator Bates, as you noted, it is more opportune to do it now. It is more ideal to do this now, and I think what's most important to note, and also an answer to a question that came up at the hearing on Thursday, I believe it was, that is correct, Senator Bates, Chair Mon Sanderson. We cannot collectively bargain. 90% of our docs, 90% of our dentists negotiate their contracts independently and individually, and this will be a great help for us. Thank you.
What do you say about a sunset? A two-year sunset? But how long are your contracts usually?
The Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, the contracts are evergreen. So they renew automatically. They just continue on.
Well, Madam Chair, even though they're evergreen, once you sign a contract, there's a renewal date on them. And if you don't end the contract, they continue, or don't change the contract, they continue. Are those on an annual basis, or biannual basis, or does it vary from contract to contract?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Bates, my understanding is that it would vary from contract to contract.
Madam Chair, I would like to submit, if we have time, a sunset in 2 years on this. Would that be appropriate, do you think?
Let's get Senator Morris's...
The discussion that I had with my dentist, Madam Chair, was that, in fact, I asked him, I said, can you fax me a copy of your contract language just to give me an idea of what's that? And he said, no, I don't have a contract. He said, I submit my schedule of fees, and so with this evergreen rolling, He submits his full schedule of fees to ODS and then goes about his business. So apparently there's something in the works to change that model. And that's what this bill is addressing. Am I correct?
I'm sorry. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Morris. He sends in the fee schedule annually and then...
And that's it. He's on about it.
They don't see it again unless somebody, one either the practitioner or the insurance provider, makes it.
Yeah.
I assume he probably does have a contract stuck away
somewhere.
In a cabinet somewhere that he signed 20 years ago.
Yeah, but
probably can't even find. And the contract rolls every year, and that's the way it is.
Okay. All right, well, we're in work session, and there is a suggestion to have a sunset put on it. Are there votes without the sunset? I need to know how the committee feels.
I would support it without the sunset, but...
Without? Okay, then we're in work session. I'm waiting for a motion.
Well, wait a minute.
Madam Chair, can we...
It will be a
can I offer a conceptual amendment to the bill? It's a pretty... Can I do that?
Well, I would like to...
Not really.
I think we ought to do our due diligence completely, and if Doc Bates wants a sunset, I would say let's do a sunset.
Okay. I just need to get so that there... Okay. We have a constitutional problem without a sunset, so, I mean, I'm just reading body language here, and I assume... So we will be bringing this back. So I'm going to close. We're going to work on an amendment for this one. We can't do conceptual. It has to be in writing. And we will be moving the bill probably one way or another when we meet again. All right. We're closing the
whatever that is.
Yes, it will be today. It has to be today. 3665, and I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3632. And I would like to call, is it Amy or Sean, Amy and Sean forward on 3632. Remind us, Rick, what this bill is.
Basically, this is the pay or play bill. Chair, that requires the Oregon Health Authority to conduct a study on the viability of a system in Oregon by which employers either provide insurance or would have to be paid into a pool to provide insurance for the uninsured.
All right. Colleagues, we won't be moving the bill, but it would be nice if we could get a letter from the health authority to me and the members of this committee that the employer-sponsored health insurance will be studied by the health authority. And I'd like the health authority, Amy, to give us some feedback on that.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, from the record, my name is Amy Favre. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Health Authority, and we would be happy to provide you a letter stating that the Oregon Health Authority, through the Office for Health Policy and Research, will be doing this study as part of the work that we were tasked to do under House Bill 2009, and we will report back to you in December of this year.
Excellent.
Good.
Any other comments? Is that sufficient then? All right. So if you would have that done within the next week or two?
We can get it done within the week.
Okay. Great. Thank you. With that, I will close the public, unless anyone else wants to testify on 3632, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3632. And colleagues, we're going to meet at 3 o'clock. I don't know where.
We have a veterans meeting. We have a veterans meeting at 3:30, which there may be.
Should be able to get. We should know what we can do with these bills at 3, so we should be done by 3:30. Is that all right?
Madam Chair, I have a 3 o'clock Finance and Revenue Committee, but if you need me to come
for vote,
just come
because you'll sort it.
If you could do that.
Let's do it that way. We're not going to testify anything. We're going to see which amendments can go, which can't, and because there are underlying bills that we want to pass anyway.
I'll be in A. So
A. Okay. Excellent. All right. We'll say 3 o'clock in hearing room
C.
B
or C?
C.
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 We're just recessing.
Okay. So now we are recessing until then. 3 o'clock.